in the thickness. As we have Willis, 33 years, starting in September of 1982. The technical net is a gathering of curious people. Let me find out where my voice is coming out of here. Oh, that's where it is. Who want to know more about radio equipment, the radio art, and they come together and teach each other. There's a large amount of brain power in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, where this repeater has moderately good coverage in that area, or about 800 square miles of that area are covered by this repeater. The repeater also has interconnection by way of Internet, IRLP, Echolink, and as such, we sometimes get questions from further out of the area. Let me drop. John, KC2WGB, monitors the Echo Link as well as the chat room. So if you've had trouble getting through because we don't leave enough space between our transmissions, John, by monitoring that website, will know about it, and you'll get your message through. So even if you're far away listening to this TechNet, there's ways you can get your question in to us. That preamble I give because there's always new people after many years. The 33 years the TechNet's been around, you would like to think that everybody knows about it. Of course not. There's always new people getting their ham license and new people discovering it. And so they want to know, what is it? And as I said before, it's a gathering of curious people helping each other understand the art and science of radio. This beautiful website where the last 10 years of TechNet are recorded, and you can play that back. It's run by a very enthusiastic guy, KC2NJI. Mike is his name. And by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it comes in 1 hour reels, and you can play back past TechNet. In fact, some people are not able to stay up for the whole 4 hours, and therefore, they want to hear more of it. Let me drop it. They go to that website a few days after the TechNet, when the latest recording will be appearing on the website. It doesn't happen usually right away. Wednesday, Thursday of the beginning of next week is when this particular recording will take place. It will be available to you. And then people will download it to their portable piece of equipment so that now they can listen to the TechNet shifted in time, and they can listen to it while they're on the train, while they're on the noon hour, while they're driving to work, whatever. So there are people who do that. There's another good website by Mike number two, K1MJM, which is on limarctechnet.com, L-I-M-A-R-C, technet.com. I don't think there's a dot in there. Limarctechnet.com. And there's many other pieces of information relevant to this technical net. Past articles and diagrams and things like that, and photographs. Photographs of some of the people involved. Let me drop. So those mic number one and mic number two website, very handy. We have a very loose schedule that we use. During the first hour, we take people who check in who do have a question or a comment. You need not check in because you're listening. Please don't. After 33 years, and 1,597, this is the 1,597th technical net. By now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So we don't spend the time of long lists of people who sign in to tell us that they're listening. So you check in because you do have a question or a comment. You give us your call letters and your name, because I'm so forgetful, and I like referring back to people by name. And then you do that to let us know. Your call letters, your name, and the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. And we take that list of people during the first hour or so. Depending on the enthusiasm of the particular question, we might end before an hour, or we might actually stretch it to 2 hours. We go with the flow, if you know what I mean. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag. And so for people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment that they can talk to us directly, by various means they communicate with John, and he chooses one, two, three, or four of those questions that have general interest, and we then discuss those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert. And this coming August, there's going to be a spacecraft that was launched in 2011. August 2011 is going to arrive in July of 2016, which is going to be a very major vehicle making significant measurements of Jupiter. So maybe Paul will be telling us about that particular mission. Okay, that's a loose schedule. Don't get upset if we modify the living daylights out of that schedule, as we sometimes do. Let me drop. And one of the complaints that we hear occasionally is that people will say, hey, you guys get too technical. Why don't you give me the simple answer? As I gave you guys an example last week, sometimes the simple answer, where they want a simple yes or no, will this work? The answer is yes and no. It depends. On top of that, whenever a person is learning brand new knowledge, it's always a little bit uncomfortable. If you already had some familiarity with the material being covered, then yes, it's easy to sit and listen to it. If it's difficult to listen to it, quite often it's because the material is so new to you. All brand new equipment is uncomfortable. By way of that recording at amateurradio.tangovictor, you can play it back a number of times and eventually make some more sense out of it. And even if you don't understand certain portions of it, you're allowed to check in that week or the next week and say, what did that word mean? What did that concept mean? Explain that to me. So the more curious amateurs want to know not only what works, but how it works, why it works. That's what the real true scientist does, in my opinion. And the true scientist also depends more on experimental evidence. I think it was Thomas Edison who said that one good experiment is worth a thousand theories by so-called experts. One good experiment can have a hell of a lot more validity and more traceability to the Bureau. We amateurs are extremely good at experimenting with our antennas and our feed lines and our transmitters and our receivers and the stuff in our backyard, the stuff in our basement, and so on. By way of talking to our fellow amateurs, we do the experiment and find out what works and what doesn't work and discuss it with each other. That's part of what goes on here. Let me drop it.
And you can log in again.
Okay, so one of the first things we're going to do tonight, I was told, is that we're going to set aside some time for our president, Mr. Joe, W2BMP, who I believe wants to make a message. So, Joe, if you're available, go right ahead. W2BMP, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening to everybody. You may have noticed that the ARRL Hudson Division recently sent out an email to all of its members regarding malicious interference. Limark is very proud of the progress we've made recently in aggressively addressing the malicious interference issue. Limark also stands by the ARRL in this fight against those who would use our airwaves illegally. Please wait. Malicious interference is nothing new to radio. What is new, however, is that right now, for the first time ever, we have a unique window of opportunity to bring this issue of malicious interference to the attention of our government officials. It boils down to pure numbers, folks. The more reports that are filed, the greater the likelihood that our politicians will help us do something about it. Again, we only have a very limited time to prove our case to our representatives and the FCC and get them to listen. Please wait. Our best information suggests that we easily have at least 500 people on average listening to this net. At any given time, that could be many more people listening than that. Due to the popularity of this net, we urge everyone listening on tonight's net to immediately report any malicious interference you may hear on this or any repeater directly to us. We will forward these reports to the ARRL for action, as well as enter the data that you report into our own database and monitoring system for future use. This goes for tonight, as well as any other night on this repeater or any repeater system you may frequent. It only takes two steps. Step one, if you hear malicious interference, try your best to listen on the input. If you can't listen on the input, that's fine. File a report anyway. Step two, go to www.limark.org. All you have to do is, as soon as you hit Limark, just click on the button that says File an RFI Report. That's all there is to it. Every report is extremely important, and your report could easily be the report that makes all the difference. Please remember, if you hear something, please report it. Good evening to all, 73. I'm Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike Papa. Back to Net. Thank you, Dick.
This is K2RIW. The message you just heard was from our president, Joe, W2BMP, the president of Limark. Anybody with any further questions or comments on what Joe just told us, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW. Okay. Thank you, Joe. And the repeater is sounding better and better these days. So obviously, from my point of view, progress is being made. And now, at this time, we're going to take the check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, listening.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and yes.
W-H-Y-Y-Y. Joe. Yes.
So far we've gotten Joe number one, Joe number two. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes if you've got a question or comment right now.
B-2. Yes.
Okay, I heard W-2 and yes, but there's something in between missing. The call letters and the name. Please give me a repeat, sir.
KD2 KSB Kilo Delta 2 Kilo Sierra Bravo. Name is Phil. Yes.
Okay, we got you, Phil. KB2 Kilo Sierra Bravo. All right. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N Paul at the Space Report.
Very fine, Paul. And one last call. Anyone to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now. I am noticing, Eric, that the four beeps tonight are extremely low in volume. A little bit unusual. Okay, the first person who signed in was Joe number one, KC2QYW. What would you like to talk about, Joe? We'll discuss anything except antennas. And that was a joke. You've got a joke.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. I want to say hi to everybody. Love you guys, love you guys. I'm doing a good job here. Yeah, I was watching the Barrett Jackson car show. All those nice, beautiful cars, huh? Oh yeah, I do have a question. Out on my porch, Dick. We have some wildlife animals that live in that live in my backyard. A couple days ago, I saw two squirrels up on my porch chewing away on my friggin' coax cable. My question to you, Dick, is if I buy one of those robot owls, I don't know if you ever, I think I might have saw that on one of my catalogs. It's like a robot owl, and the head rotates back and forth. My question to you is, or anybody out there, do you think that will work to scare off the squirrels off my porch? Back to you guys.
And now the beeps are the full volume. What are those squirrels doing? Are you saying that the squirrels will sometimes chew into your coaxial cable? And if it's a piece of RG8, I'm amazed that if the squirrel will chew through the outer jacket, through the copper braid, he'd have to chew through the copper braid in order to do any signal attenuation. And even that wouldn't do it. You'd be amazed how much... If it was a foam-filled coax and water got in there, yes, it would give you a lot of attenuation. But if it was a polyethylene coax and the animal chewed a hole on one half of the diameter of the coax and you tried to measure the insertion loss, it would be so low you wouldn't be able to measure it. So how badly did the squirrels chew into your coax cable? Have they just sunk their teeth into the outside and made teeth marks? You can certainly cover that up with some tape just to make it look pretty, to make sure water didn't get in there. So I didn't think squirrels would eat coax. So give us some further words on that, Joe. What did those squirrels do? And maybe there's a way you can give them a meal off to one side so that they would consider that more attractive than your coax. KC2QYW. K2YW. Great, Joe.
Yeah, Roger that. So true, so true. I have to investigate. I have to go out there in the ports, you know, when the weather gets a little warmer. I couldn't go out there today, but by looking out the window, it's the outer part. I don't know if they're just doing it just to play, like, to play around with it, like using it as a toy, playing with it. But I, you know, I could see like cuts on the outside jacket. I discovered this a couple of days ago when I looked out my window, because I heard some noise out in the porch, and then I I saw the squirrel with the cable in his mouth, and he was shaking his head around like a freaking pit bull. So I was like, knocking on the window, I was like, hey, get out of here, and then after a while, they both left, so I don't know. To answer your question, that's what they were doing.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, we've got about three people. They're trying to make comments or covering up each other up. If your coax cables are going through a hole in the wall, and particularly in the wintertime, squirrels and other kinds of vermin like to go through the smallest hole they can find. They can sometimes squeeze their way in. They want to be inside of the warm house. So, is it possible that your coax cable are entering the house through a wall hole, and they're trying to expand the diameter of that hole so that they and their family can easily go in and out? So that can become a point of entrance and exit. Is that possibly what was going on, Joe? KC2QYW, K2YW.
Yes, sorry about that. I should explain myself a little better with the coax cable. No, I have all my cables coming out my window over here in my room on the second floor. And we've got a porch out here and stuff. And I also have the AC, my air conditioner, out in the window. And what I do is I snake the coax cable through the side of the AC over here. And then I got the porch, you know, over here. Yeah, I think that was your question, right? Like, oh, yeah, to answer your question, I have all my coax cables going out my window where my air conditioner is. And the coax cables are just laying down on the porch. Maybe I should get some Gorilla tape and tape them up on the railing, like snake it through the, you know, like the outside railing or something like that, instead of leaving them on the floor of the back porch over here. Back to you.
We've got two or three people who want to make comments. Let's see if we can find out the call letters of the people first who want to make comments. So you guys start giving me your call letters right now. KC2WGB was one of those. He was the second one I heard. Who was the other two? Over to you guys.
KD2IXP.
Okay, we heard GXM and IXP. WB2GXM. Thought of your name. And you're going to have to shout into that mic. You're using extremely low modulation index here. You've got very low audio. WB2GXM, start off by shouting and give us your name and then your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Exec's name is Rich. I have two suggestions for things you might apply to the outside of the coax.
Okay, Rich. You're now up to one quarter of normal volume, so shout a little louder if you can, and give us your suggestions of what can be applied to the outside of the coax. Go right ahead, Rich.
One is hot pepper with Vaseline, the other is peppermint oil. Squirrels hate peppermint.
Okay, Vaseline and peppermint oil, because squirrels hate the peppermint oil. Sounds like a good suggestion. KB2 IXP, I think it was. Go right ahead, sir. Yeah, I think it's John. Go right ahead, John.
That's right. Good evening, Dick. Had a similar problem, not involving coax. Has used spearmint oil, which you can get in a spray form at Lowe's or Home
Yeah, I'm awful glad you gave me that suggestion, John. There is a place in my house where the power drop cable comes into the house, and varmints have come along and they managed to chew that hole a little bit larger so that they can get in there in the wintertime and stay warm. So the spearmint oil sounds like a good thing. So I think you're saying Home Depot and Lowe's sells this spearmint oil, which is intended, I guess, for repelling rodents. Is that true? Roughly, what's the price of that, John? KB2IXP, K2IW, KD2IXP, K2IW, the TechNet?
It's relatively inexpensive, especially when faced with the cost of replacing that cable, the coax. You can get it in a spray, like a pump spray. It comes in 8 ounce, 12 ounce, depending upon the brand. You can make a mist or a stream, whatever, by adjusting the nozzle. And it works on all varmints, including all rodents, mice, rats, squirrels. It even works on cockroaches and ants and things of that nature. The owl will probably work for certain birds, certainly not other raptors, but it's not going to do anything for the squirrels. The squirrels will probably end up chewing on the owl.
That would be quite a scene, John. Thank you. The other John, KC2WGB. I didn't think there were any varmints and rodents and bad animals there in Staten Island. Didn't think they would dare go on that island. Let's see what John has to say. KC2WGB, K2RW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yeah, we got a few. Those aromatic oils are fine, but moth oils also work. Like you could stuff them in that opening you're talking about. And yeah, the owl's a joke. The squirrels will just make mockery of it. But it is good for pigeons and things like that. Okay, the best thing I've found is eventually the rain is going to wash away the scent and all. Leave the coax with seal tight and your problem's over. You know, buy a 10-foot length at an electrical store, whatever size you need. Just leave the stuff and they'll leave it alone. But squirrels are notorious for eating through lead-covered cable, vinyl-covered cable, all the PVCs, the fiber cables. They eat through everything, Dick. I don't know what they do with it, but they do eat through it. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
What would make them stop eating through the seal-tight, John? I guess the seal-tight is just one more layer of things that you keep track of as they're chewing their way through. Or is there something about seal-tight that repels them? Back to you, John.
Yes, Dick, the seal tight has an armor element like BX cable. It's covered with plastic, a vinyl, or you can get it just raw. But if you don't want it to rust, just buy it with the plastic coating. It's relatively cheap, and they're not going through that armor.
There are kinds of seal tight where you can split them and easily lay the cable into that trough and then close them up again. There are other kinds of seal tight where you have to feed the cable in from one end. Well, you've got a bunch of cables where, let's assume now that on Joe's porch, let's assume that the cable starts off from the shack, travels for 20 feet through various zigzags in the ceiling and whatever, goes to the porch. After the porch, it goes another 20 feet to go up the tower. For him to take apart those cables, to feed them endwise through the seal tight, could be a pain in the tail. So is there a version of seal tight which has the armoring, but still you can split it open and you don't have to feed the end of the cable through? KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, there's a version that's like spiral wrap, but no, there's no problem. All he has to do is say it's, I don't know what he has, RG58 or RG8, by the proper size, you know, maybe inch and a half, and just drop his cables down it. And he would probably only have to buy a 10-foot length of it. Maybe he can put all his cables in one, maybe he'd need two. But that's armor, and they're not going to go through that. They may eat up the vinyl coating on it here and there, but they don't bother with that much.
Okay, you said the magic words. The fact that it's a spiral wrap means I can put it in the middle of the cable without having to go through the rigmarole of obtaining the end of the cable in my hand. Well done. Let's see if Joe needs any fill on all of the above. Looks like we've got a couple of potential solutions there for you, Joe. KC2QYW. K2YW the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that, roger that. Yeah, I'll try everything. Yeah, thank you, guys. Thank you. I didn't mean to tie up the whole net. I didn't think my question was going to last for like 20 minutes or so. I also want to say hi to Ray out there. I know he's listening. I saw him at the meeting today at the Yonkers. Yonkers meeting today. His name is Ray, KC2MMY. Just wanted to do a quick shout-out and say hi to him. I also have another question. I don't know if I should wait until next week, but I'll just ask you right now, Dick. My question is, I was wondering, how many watts is this repeater here? Because everywhere I go in the car, I can always hear you guys on this repeater. I was just assuming how many watts it is. Back to you.
I don't know the exact number of watts. We could go to Eric and find out. But the main thing that allows you to hear it at long distances, as I see it, Joe, is the fact that it's mounted on a 33-story building. That building is mounted on a chunk of land that's around 300 feet above sea level. So the tops of those antennas are close to 700 feet in the air, you know, which is, what, two-thirds of the distance of the Empire State Building, so to speak. So as you guys have heard me say before, altitude, altitude, altitude is what makes an antenna work well. You're handy-talky if you've got a pair of them and you've got a friend that walks away from you on flat land in your neighborhood. By the time he gets a mile, his signal is starting to get ratty, maybe 2 miles. So you would think a handy-talkie is only good for 2 miles. Put that exact same handy-talkie in the hands of astronaut Owen Garriott, W5LFL, while he's in the space shuttle, 160 miles above the Earth, while he's over northern Texas, 1,500 miles away, and he'll sound like gangbusters to you. So is a handy-talkie good for 1 mile, or is it good for 1,500 miles? And the answer is yes and yes, under the right conditions. So the main thing you're hearing is not because they're running a zillion watts, it's because it's mostly altitude. If Eric happens to be available, maybe he'll give us a little bit more information. KE2EJ, the man who keeps all this equipment running. K2HIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Eric, if you're available.
K2IWK2J. A couple of things. The reason why the four beeps get a little lower is because there's another carrier happening. Don't forget, we've got a number of inputs to this, so it drops it by about 60 dB.
Yes, that must
be the elevation. KB2A is like 150 feet, plus the height of the building, plus the little mast that the antenna is on. It gets you up pretty high. I don't remember the exact numbers. Not that I care. As far as power output goes, we run about 100 watts running through some cable, which gives us some loss. Let's see, we'll probably get about 85 watts of the antenna. And then the gain of the antenna is 7.5 dB. So you calculate that out, take your 85 watts, multiply 7.5 dB again, get your ELP, get your IWK3 done.
Comment? Yeah, I heard somebody say comment. Two people said comment. Of all those factors, the gain of the antenna, the amount of feed line loss, and the amount of power output, believe it or not, in my opinion, those are the minor factors. Altitude, in my mind, is the major factor. You can easily take a station master-like antenna that's at ground level in your backyard, and you do whatever is required to raise it on top of a tower, you can easily make the signal 25, 26 dB louder because of the altitude you've just added. 26 dB is a 400-to-1 ratio. So in other words, just raising the altitude of the antenna from your backyard to the top of the tower is the equivalent of raising your power 400 times. Lots of people have done that experiment. Who is it? Give me your call letters first, because there's more than one person saying they've got a comment. Person number one first, give me your call letters, K2RIW. Okay, that was a triple, and I've got nothing. Give it another try. The person trying to give us your comment, give me your call letters, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Joe?
Yeah, Joe, but there was somebody else trying to make a comment. Who was that?
D2HUC, Dick.
Okay, Mr. HUC, give us your call and give us your information right now, sir.
My father lives on the 32nd floor of the same building this repeat is on. And I've been up there on his balcony with a 5-watt Baofeng and hit repeaters and hot pods clear as day. That's got to be, what, about 25 miles, 30 miles with 5 watts.
Okay, that's a very strong piece of evidence that altitude really does it. Who is the other person who had a comment? Give me a call letters right now.
WB2GXM Rich with a comment.
Very fine, Rich. Whatever you did, you now have some audio. Keep doing it. I'm guessing you had to change rigs. Maybe the first rig was a Baofeng with an extremely narrow modulation, is a guess on my part. WB2GXM, go right ahead, Rich, with your information. You sound a lot better.
You have hit the arrow right in the center of the target. I have just ditched the Baofeng. I'm about to throw it into the toilet. All right, first of all, before we get too far off topic, where do you get seal tight? WB2GXM.
I'm reasonably sure that Lowe's and Home Depot has that. As the person who was suggesting the seal tight, I'd say quite a few people were suggesting it. Eric was probably one of them. Eric, am I correct in assuming that an electrical supply house, Lowe's, and Home Depot all have seal tight? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now you got me confused with, I think it was John that was telling me that. I'm not aware of it. By the way, the altitude above sea level of the hill that the thing is mounted on is 250 feet. So add your 700 feet to that.
Very fine. KD2IXP, John, was I correct in assuming that you can get seal tight at Lowe's, Home Depot, as well as an electrical supply store? KD2IXP, K2IW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, sir. That was the others, John. KC2WGB, who's talking about the seal tight. He would know better than I, because I have never purchased it before. Sorry.
Looks like I got all my Johns mixed up here. KC2WGB, we're finally getting down to the right person. I should have gone to Staten Island in the first place. Go ahead, John. WXP, K2RIW. WGB, I'll let you get you right. WGB, please go.
Yeah, hey, you will do, you know, no problem. Yeah, electrical supply store, I don't know if Home Depot carries the metal flex type of seal tight, but that's where you want to go to an electrical supply store, because you probably want to get a larger diameter than a homeowner would be using. And you could also use green field. It's not as attractive, it's not gray, it's that silver color, and it picks up a little bit of rust, but either green field or seal tight will do the job.
Yeah, Dick, actually you can buy it from Home Depot and Lowe's. And they also supply for electrical contractors that have got half inch, 3/4 inch, 1 inch, the whole shebang. I didn't hear the question before, so. But that's the answer. You can get it at Lowe's and Home Depot.
So, John, looks like it's widely available. KC2QYW, the guy who asked the original question, a good one. Need any further fills, Joe? K2YW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, I promise. This is, I guess it's a question, my last one. Wow, you guys are like the largest, I'm just reading it in the book, the largest amateur radio club in the USA. One of the largest. Wow, I'm impressed. I think I might have sold the tower today. I don't know where it's located. I was driving down the, Cross County, from the Hudson River Parkway down by the, Cross County Parkway, and I saw a really, really big tower. I don't know if that's your, tower. Over there, I'm really, that's my question. I don't know where your tower is located, but I'm really, really impressed.
Yeah, the structure that this repeater is mounted on is a group of three buildings right at the Nassau-Suffolk border. No, Nassau-Queens border, right at the Nassau-Queens border. It's very visible from southern state, looking south. It's also quite visible from the Long Island Expressway. It's in a town called Glen Oaks. So there are three very tall apartment buildings, side by side, all tilted with reference to each other. And the tallest, most eastern building is where the antenna is located. So you're not looking for a tower. You're looking for a building with a bunch of sticks on top of it, on top of the building, which is all these two-way radio services. Okay, the next guy on our list was Joe, WB2RYY. Mr. Robentini, go right ahead with your questions or comments, Joe. K2RYW in the TechNet.
It's 342 watts ERP and about 562 EIRP.
Fantastic, Eric. Go ahead, Joe.
Very good, Mr. Nagel. I'm actually remembering my call there. You're always going to try to stick a B in there somehow. You can't get that guy out of your mind, can you? My question is on how to do with power systems for houses, the solar power systems, the kind that are connected to the grid that lets you put power back into them. How do they keep regulation, not as far as frequency, but as far as output level? How do they keep that in sync with your power level that can fluctuate in a neighborhood going up and going down? Since they have to put some sort of power into the net, into the network, when they're supplying more power than being used in your house. Back to you. You understand the question completely?
Yeah, I think I do, Joe. And this gets into one of my favorite puzzles that I often ask reasonably smart electrical engineers who have worked on inverters and things like that. Under normal circumstances, your house is primarily a resistive load. You connect a 100-ohm load, which is equivalent to a 100-watt light bulb, across your 120-volt line, and you'll draw 1.2 amperes, and that would be 120 watts in that case. So normally, the resistive load causes the power to flow from Con Ed or Loco or LiPo or whatever toward you. But now you've got a source of power. It could be your motor generator set. It could be an inverter or whatever. And you want the power to go back into the system so that your watt-hour meter, which, by the way, every watt-hour meter really keeps track of which direction the power is flowing. Literally, if you're plowing power back into the line, your watt-hour meter will flow backwards, and the numbers will decrease as to the watt-hours you've consumed. And so, if you've got a system where you have the ability to pump power back in, you're supposed to inform them, you're supposed to put on the right kind of instrumentation, because they don't want their watt-hour meter running backwards, because the rate at which they pay you when you pump power in versus the rate at which you pay them when you use power, those two rates are not the same. Let me drop. But then the main question that I quite often ask my fellow electronic engineers, if I want the power to flow back, do I advance the phase or do I advance the voltage? You'd be amazed how many people are mystified by that. You could try advancing the phase, and if you did that, you would just present a reactive load to Loco that wouldn't be desirable. You make the power flow from you back in the other direction by advancing the voltage. But I'm saying the word voltage in quotes. It's really a constant current like system, so to speak. In other words, if you've got the ability to pump a kilowatt back into them, which means you've got close to 10 amperes of excess power at 120 volts. By the way, you really should be doing it at 240. But if you're doing it at 120 volts, for my example, and you've got 10 extra amperes, you would adjust your voltage and or your current generator so that what you're generating is exactly the right frequency, exactly the right phase, but you're now trying to make your voltage, let me pick a number, a couple of millivolts or whatever higher, depending on the resistance of the system. You're trying to make your voltage a little bit higher, so that 10 amperes flows in the other direction from you to them. So an intelligent system that does that is trying to advance the voltage, but it's got a servo mechanism increasing and decreasing the apparent voltage of generation at your house so that 10 amperes of the right phase and the right frequency flows from you to them. Over to you. And by the way, when it comes to Loco and Con Ed and the grid for the United States sharing power back and forth, the system is the same. You try to advance the voltage. In some cases the voltage you're advancing. Let me drop it. Because many of their systems have an equivalent resistance of micro-ohms. So the voltage that you're advancing, you might advance your voltage of your generating set, your local power generating system, you might advance it 1 millivolt, and that may make 5,000 amperes flow from you to them, because the resistance of the system is so small. So you don't monitor voltage per se. You monitor current and the direction of the flow of that current, and you know when you've got it correct. WA2RYY, K2RAW, there, Joe.
Okay, so that would mean that these power systems have to be putting the power back into the electrical system across something like a shunt, where they could constantly measure the voltage drop across a shunt and know, or something like that, to know how much current they're constantly supplying. Because I always wondered about that. Like, if you get the voltage going up or get the voltage going down, sometimes rather quickly, it may drop, one, say, like a tenth, two-tenths, three-tenths of a volt. It made me wonder how your system could keep up and something like that without, you know, upsetting itself and going crazy.
Yeah, Joe, you said the word shunt, and you really meant series. You measure current by series instrumentation. And because by your and my standards, Con Ed, LUCO, LIPA, New Jersey Power and Light, whoever you're using, if you look back into their signal generator from your house, and you measure the apparent impedance, their apparent impedance to you is milliohms. It's almost a short circuit, so to speak. By short circuit, I mean it's an ideal voltage generator. You could try to pump enough voltage back into them that you're raising their voltage or lowering their voltage. You're not going to do much. You're a mouse trying to move an elephant, if you know what I mean. They dominate. The exact voltage they generate, that's the voltage you're going to get. And now your system has to monitor current and adjust the current generating capability up and down. Now, there's many a kind of an alternator-like system that's generating power at your house, which really is the equivalent of an alternator. And in many cases, the alternator determines what voltage comes out of your alternator is a function of what field current put into the alternator. That's the way that the alternator in your automobile works. You change the field current by way of a servo mechanism. There's a series drop transistor that changes the amount of current you put into that field winding, the field winding of your alternator. That's the rotary field winding, and that's what determines what voltage slash current comes out of it. Your alternator from your automobile has a very similar situation. The battery in your car, when it's fully charged, again, is milliohms. And so to get the power to flow from your alternator back into your battery, you're trying to raise the voltage is what you think you're doing. But the voltage that you're raising compared to the voltage that the battery is seeing, that difference is...
Repeater, time out.
The voltage that you're generating, let me check on... Okay, we still got the eastern input. The voltage you're generating versus the voltage the battery sees at one instant of time differs only by millivolts, because you've only got milliohms of resistance between the two. So your alternator thinks it's making 13.8 volts, and your battery is getting 13.8 volts. By way of you adjusting the current in that field winding, you're really judging what current it can generate, whether or not it can generate 10 amperes or 100 amperes. Some of the alternators in our automobiles have the ability to put out a total of 100 amperes of current. And there's also a voltage sensing circuit in there to make sure you don't go above 13.8 or 13.9, something like that. And occasionally that fails. Once in a blue moon, I'll see an automobile driving down the road where the lights are either extremely dim, and I know something's wrong with their system, and they're running on 9 volts, if you know what I mean, because some part of their alternator system has failed, and the battery's in the process of failing. Or I've seen the opposite, of where they're burning out light bulbs real fast, and they put a voltmeter on to find out that they've already sulfated the battery, and the alternator in its failure mode is capable of putting out 18 volts, and the whole damn automobile is trying to run on 18 volts. So this gives you a little bit of input. The main thing you have to do is monitor series current, AC series current, in order to, if you've got a kilowatt of excess power, which is roughly 10 amperes, you're going to adjust your system to continuously pump 10 amperes of slow. slightly higher voltage at exactly the right frequency and phase back into that system, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet. Stand by a minute, Joe.
Be the gun. Pick up the other guy in a second. Yeah, I had a success with something, and they said that the your meters on your house don't run backwards. That's why they put two of them on there, and that was a disagreement. I thought the meters will run backwards, but like you said, I thought the second meter that's put on the system is to tell when you are generating power into the system, and that's what they go by as far as what they do to calculate how much they owe you.
Yeah, if you did not inform them that you're one of these people capable of generating power, and you want them to pay you for it, and they now install a second meter on the house, which keeps track of your generation versus their generation, because there's two different rates. They're going to pay you a lower rate than you pay them, so to speak. However, if you did not tell them, if you just simply set up your system and naively start pumping power back in, their watt-hour meter, if it doesn't have a ratchet in it, the electronics of the watt-hour meter is capable of running backwards. Let's see what Eric's got to say about all of the above. KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I've had the opportunity to work on what they call Sunny Boy in British for a PV. The way they keep track of the voltage that they're making is they actually do something similar to what I do in terms of the current measurement. They actually go through a little hunk of ferrite that's got a winding on it, and that measures the magnetic field, and that's how they know how much current is passing through the line. And today, if you put PVs on your house, PSE&G will come and put a smart meter on your house, so that way they can keep track of who's doing what. QRWK2J.
Yeah, I should have realized that in order to measure series current with the normal instrumentation that we amateurs have access to, you would put a 1 milliohm series resistor and measure voltage drop across it. Well, in the case of a short circuit, you're going to be blowing out that resistor. It's going to be acting like a fuse. A more intelligent technique is to put the right kind of a transformer there, a ferrite-like coil, where one piece of wire goes through the center of the ferrite, and now there's a winding on it that goes to a resistor and your metering circuit. And now, as far as the metering that you've added, that one piece of series wire going through the middle of that toroid does not change by even 1 milliohm the series resistance of the LIPA circuit going into your house. And yet, by way of that toroid, you can measure the current flowing through that wire and therefore keep track of what current and which direction. You'll see a different phase angle of that winding on your ferrite toroid coil as the current is toward you or toward them. There'll be a phase change on that winding, and with the right kind of instrumentation you can know that. So are you on the threshold of possibly putting photovoltaics at your house there, Joe? W2RYY. Maybe you're going very green. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, it was just simply a curiosity question because I want to know.
Well, if you want the map, read about Kirchhoff's law.
Yeah, well, we're talking about AC circuits here, and that gets a little bit hairy. When it comes to the proper phasing and frequencies of AC circuits to have the power flow in the desired direction, there aren't very many books that explain it in a way that's easy to understand. So it's a subject that can easily be misunderstood. In the case of the 385 kilovolt lines that are doing power distribution or power transmission, the so-called grid across the United States, boy, they got some huge voltages and some huge currents, and monitoring those, at first it sounds very difficult. I know darn well it can be done with a very simple RFID tag, a radio frequency identification tag. If you mounted one of those literally on the wire, but it sits on top of the wire, connected to nothing, and it could easily monitor the local magnetic field flowing through that that cable, and therefore know how much current is flowing through it. And then you could, by way of your RFID interrogator, stand on the ground, aim the antenna towards this tag that's up there on that piece of wire, interrogate that tag, and know what current is flowing. And there's even ways that Tide could keep keep track of history for you as to what current flowed during the last hour, the last 24 hours, and so on. That would be a very inexpensive instrumentation that's right at the horse's mouth, so to speak. In other words, because you have other junctions in that power transmission system, you'd like to know how much current is flowing in this particular piece of wire today of those three wires. And that would be very nice to do with an RFID tag. I don't know whether or not a product like that yet exists.
Repeater, time out.
I don't know if a product like that yet exists, but the technology is there, waiting to be used, if you know what I mean. There are people who make RFID tags where not only does it give you a 96-bit identifier for that particular tag, but there are slightly specially made tags where you can put hundreds of bits of information in the tag. You could mount this passive tag on a cardboard box in Hong Kong, and as that box goes to various shipping ports, the right person would interrogate that tag, add stories to it, and by the time your box arrives in San Francisco or New York City, you read all the stories that are on that tag and know which port it went to, how long it stayed there, what the local temperature was like, and so on. So you can write a very elaborate story onto these tags. The tag itself in the UHF version, let me drop it. The UHF version has got a dipole antenna printed on a piece of plastic, which is about 4 inches long, and there's a little black dot in the middle of that dipole, which you can just barely see without looking at it with a magnifying glass or a microscope, and in there is all the electronics that does all that magic. Amazing little things. And I've worked with a fair amount of these things over the last 10 years with a particular consulting client that I had. Let's see now. We've gone to Joe number one, Joe number two. I think the next person was Phil. KB2, Kilo Sierra Bravo. Phil, I think you had a question. K2RIW and TechNet. Go right ahead, Phil.
Yes, thank you, Dick. It's KD2KSB, Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Sierra Bravo. Yeah, actually, I have two questions. They're related, but if you only want to take the first one, that's fine with me. My first question is with regard to an inverted dipole versus a horizontal dipole. I'm considering putting a 40-meter dipole somewhere on the property, and I'm wondering what the propagation characteristics would be, speaking directionally, with regard to an inverted 40-meter dipole versus a horizontal 40-meter dipole. The second question, let me drop. Second question is, I'm running a new antenna system on my boat, which is basically a 2-meter system, I'm running a new coax cable, and I'm wondering how critical it is with regard to right angle on the coax cable. I'm using RG8X on the cable, on the antenna feed, and I'm wondering if it's critical to avoid right angles at any cost, if I should have a certain radius built into those cables or not. Over to you, Dick, and thank you. And if you only want to take the first question, I understand.
We're probably going to take both of them, Phil. In the case of a pure, flat-out parallel dipole, parallel to the ground, which is the picture you see in all the books, it gives you purely horizontal polarization of transmission by the time that HF signal on 40 meters bounces off the ionosphere, bounces in quotes. It acts like it bounces. It's doing something a little more complicated. By the time it goes through that ionosphere, it bounces back to the ground, back to the ionosphere, and gets to your buddy in London, we'll say. It has been twisted in polarization. The ionosphere is a plasma with a local magnetic field, and that combination gives you something called Faraday polarization rotation. So that signal is going to rotate a couple of times. Even though you're issuing a pure horizontal signal, there's a medium good chance that the signal is going to be vertically polarized when it gets to your buddy in London. Common sense would lead you to believe your buddy in London should issue a vertical signal back to you to be horizontal. You're assuming the ionosphere obeys reciprocity. The ionosphere does not obey reciprocity. the rate at which it twists when going from east to west and the rate at which it twists when going from west to east is a different rate. Let me drop. Therefore, the possibility exists that you launch a pure horizontal signal on Long Island. Your buddy in England gets a pure vertical signal. If your buddy in England transmits a pure vertical signal to you, it might arrive vertical at your house. So polarization is a little bit crazy. That's what a pure horizontal flat-out dipole does. An inverted D gives you an advantage. Two advantages I can think of. One, only the center has to be up high. The edges can be down quite a bit lower. Number two, the pure horizontal dipole radiates only broadside. It has a null off the two ends. If you could see it in three-dimensional space, the pure horizontal dipole has an antenna pattern that is a donut with the layer of your dipole going through the hole of the donut. And so the portion that radiates parallel to the ground is the portion of the donut that hits the ground, so to speak, and it's a sort of a figure-eight pattern, but primarily broadside. In the case of an inverted V, the inverted V gives you the normal broadside propagation that's horizontally polarized. Let me drop. But the inverted V does not have a null of the ends. The inverted V, when you look off the end of that dipole and you look at it, you're seeing a compressed picture of a vertical piece of wire. So that inverted V radiates a vertical polarized signal off the ends, a horizontal polarized signal broadside. It does both. You could say it has no nulling direction. So that inverted V has the double benefit. It radiates in all directions, horizontal and vertical, and the ones you now know about, and it's a lot easier to put just one high point on the dipole in the center and let the two ends droop down. But when it comes to what support structures you have on your property, let me drop it. All the conventional dipoles that almost everybody uses, horizontal dipole or inverted V, they think it must always be fed in the center. Absolutely, positively not. It's done that way 98% of the time because of pure tradition. And that's not necessarily a good tradition. There's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the center. The dipole is a high Q structure. It's got a Q of at least 10. That means it's got 10 times more stored energy compared to what it's radiating. You put 100 watts into the dipole, there's the equivalent of a kilowatt bouncing back and forth. Only 100 watts is being radiated on each individual bounce. It's a flywheel. You can feed that flywheel with a push rod near the center or near the perimeter. It's your choice. You can feed that dipole at the center, halfway from the center to the outer end, or at the outer end. You would get an extremely high performance antenna if you had, let me drop it. If you had a tall enough structure on your property where you lay out the dipole antenna as a pure vertical structure, in the case of a 40-meter dipole, which is around 67 feet long, if you got a tree that's more than 67 feet high, I've got some oak trees on my property that are 85 foot tall. I could, if I want to, string a piece of wire down that oak tree, purely vertical, and feed it at the outer end, at the bottom. There's a slight disadvantage. The outer end has an impedance of 1,500 ohms, so I'd have to use an LC network that steps up my 50 ohms to 1,500 ohms. By way of the computer program, you can go to by going to what's the name of that that school that squealed?
Berkeley.
Berkeley. You go to the Berkeley website. You go to you Google the word impedance match plus Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and up will come a computer program that asks you what's the impedance of your signal generator. In your case, it's 50 ohms and 0 ohms of reactance. What's the impedance of your load? In your case, of the outer end of a dipole, it's going to be 1,500 ohms resistive, and again, 0 ohms reactance. And it'll give you a, it'll give, and you press go, and in 1 second, that program will give you 15.